Thanks, Chris, and thank you, Itmar, for inviting me to speak today. I'm sure you'll all be pleased to know, maybe it's the end of the day, I'm the last speaker. I'm not going to talk for too long. What I'm going to try to do in the next sort of 30, 35, 40 minutes is to provide you with a sort of whistle-stop tour of the new EU trademark regulation and the new EU trademark directive. It's been a long time coming. The European Commission commissioned a study on it back in 2009, and we've had drafts going back and forth for the last few years, and finally we're actually at a stage where some of these laws are actually going to come into effect, the first of which will actually start coming into effect next Wednesday, so the 23rd of March. So that's where we're up to, and as I said, this talk is going to provide a discussion of the main substantive changes, mainly, and also touch on some of the procedural changes as well. I'm not going to go through every change, I wouldn't have time, and you wouldn't have any interest in all or most of the changes, but so I'll just focus on what I hope are the sort of more interesting ones, the ones that raise a few of the sort of more difficult questions, I suppose. So what are we actually talking about? Well, there's two pieces of legislation. First thing, we're looking at the new regulation. So it's on the slide, EU 2015-244. It is an amending regulation, so it's going to amend the current community trademark regulation. Soon to be EU trademark regulation. And most of the changes in the regulation will come into force, as I said, next Wednesday, so that's the 23rd of March, with a few exceptions. There are a few of the sort of bigger provisions, the sort of more difficult to comply with provisions that are going to come in at a later date. So as you can see on the slide there, there are some changes that are coming into force on the 1st of October 2017, so next year, and those include the removal of the requirements of a graphical representation, which I will come back to in a bit more detail later, and also the introduction of the EU certification mark. So as I said, those aren't next week, but they will be coming into force in the sort of relatively near future. So that's the regulation. So that's the sort of the piece of legislation that deals with the community trademark, or the soon-to-be EU trademark. We've also got a new directive, again on the slide. This technically is in force. It came into force in January of this year, but member states have until 14th of January 2019, so 3 years, to bring into effect the changes required by the directive. So right now we're in a sort of strange position where, as of next week, we'll have changes that have been made to the community trademark system, to the EU trademark system, but we've got a three-year period in which the changes can be made to our Trademarks Act, so to affect the UK trademark system. And before I move on to discuss the actual changes that are going to be made, I want to touch on briefly the sort of unanswered questions about what is going to happen in that interim period. And I want to do that by way of an example. Now, one of the changes I'm going to come on to look at later is the changes to the own name defence. And in summary, the change to the own name defence is that it's now only going to be available to personal defendants, so to individuals, and not to corporate defendants, so not to companies, not to corporations, not to partnerships, etc., just to individuals. So that's the change that's being made. As of March 23rd, if someone sues you for infringement of an EU trademark and you're a corporate defendant, you are not going to be able to rely on the own name defence. But what happens if they sue you for a UK for infringement of a UK trademark? Are you going to be allowed to rely on the own name defence? Well, the short answer is we simply don't know just yet. The EU case law on the effect of a directive which is in force but the deadline for implementation hasn't passed is rather complicated, and it's certainly not something I want to get into in a 30-minute time slot. But so we just don't know. Are we going to be forced to interpret the Trademarks Act in a new way? So we're going to have to sort of bend the rules and interpret it as if it means the own name defence can only apply to personal defendants? Or are we entitled to continue as we have been doing, applying an own name defence to individuals and to corporate defendants, even though that's contrary to what's going to be happening in Europe and in relation to the EU trademark? So that's one unanswered question, and unfortunately I'm not going to be able to provide you with an answer today, so I'm going to leave that one hanging. The other unanswered question is, what happens to ongoing acts? So what happens in relation to let's take an example because it's easier to look at it that way. What about a company who has been trading prior to the changes coming into force, and is continuing to trade under the same name post the changes coming into force. So, a sort of real life example, think of the case of Maya and ASOS. In that case, Maya, who were relying on their trademark ASOS, so AWSOS, to sue ASOS, ASOS, in the Court of Appeal, the Court of Appeal found that ASOS had infringed Maya's trademarks, but they were saved by the own name defense. So as a corporate defendant, pre the changes coming into force, they were entitled to rely on the own name defense. But what happens when the changes have been brought in? Is it going to be the case that Maya could now sue ASOS again and say, right, previously you could rely on that defense, but now it's not open to you? Which, on a strict reading of the law, could be the case. But is that really fair? Is it fair to say a company that's invested in a brand and did so in a way that was legitimate and legal at that time, are they really going to be told that now, having invested that money, having promoted that brand and built up a reputation in that brand, are they now going to have to change because the defense that they relied on is no longer open to them? Again, another question I can't answer, just sort of interesting points to sort of set the scene, and that may well practically be of importance, depending on how long it takes the government to bring in the changes under the directive. So I'm just going to leave those hanging, leave you thinking of them. If you have any answers, I'd love to hear them at the end. But for now, we're going to park them and move on to the actual changes that are being brought in. Firstly, the terminology, you all know this, but just to sort of, I guess, recap. Ohim is gone, or not quite, it's almost gone. Apparently, I've been informed that they changed their website yesterday, so apparently it is gone. And we now have the EU IPO. I say it like that because I don't want to attempt to say the sort of combined acronym. I have no idea how it's going to be pronounced. And I think that's something we'll have to wait and see and hear what's actually said. Similar vein, community trademark out the window, EU trademark back in, and any reference to community in the body of the legislation has now been made the union. Why? I hear you all thinking. The answer in the recitals is it's better reflects the work that the office carries out. I think that's probably fair. I know I've had clients that haven't understood what Ohim is. And secondly, it's to bring in line the terminology with the terminology that's used across the rest of Europe. And again, I think it seems like it makes sense, even if it's a little bit annoying for practitioners. So now I want to look at actually the sort of more substantive changes to the trademark law. And the first one I want to touch on is something I sort of brought up briefly at the start of the talk. It's the fact that it's no longer going to be a requirement that a sign is capable of graphical representation. What does that actually mean? Well, the new legislation provides that a representation simply has to be in a manner which enables the competent authorities and the public to determine the clear and precise subject matter of protection. So it doesn't have to be a graphical representation, it just has to be a clear and precise representation. And Recital 9 provides that that can be in any form, using any generally available technology. So in theory, we could possibly see a situation where the door is opened up to non-conventional marks to be registered perhaps a bit more easily. Sort of the ones that sort of jumped to my mind was perhaps sound marks. It might be easier to have a way in which they could be recorded and represented that isn't a graphical representation, but is a representation which is clear and precise. I do wonder, though, in those sort of circumstances, how a register might be searchable if you no longer can search for just a keyword or a key image or whatever it is. If you can't do that, how do you find these trademarks? How does a user, a normal sort of person on the street who wants to register a trademark or wants to know what they can do, how can they really do that if the register isn't searchable? So I think that's something that is, while we hope that non-conventional marks might have a bit more room to get on the register, it's subject to that requirement that it's clear and precise for the public as well as the competent authorities. So that register really still needs to be searchable. We just don't really know what the IPO is going to accept. The next change, another sort of substantive change, is the amendments to Article 7 of the regulation. So At the moment, Article 7.1e of the regulation currently provides that a sign can be refused if it consists exclusively of a shape, which results from the nature of the goods themselves, which is necessary to achieve a technical result, or which gives substantial value to the goods. Now, the amendment under the new legislation is that those exclusions, those absolute grounds of refusal, no longer apply just to shapes, but also apply to another characteristic. I don't know what that means. I don't know if you do. And again, if you have any advice for me at the end, that would be great. But I think what it's saying is, you know, if the colour of a product is necessary to obtain a technical result, I can't see how it would be, but if it or if it gives substantial value, or if the smell of a product gives it a substantial value, then those sorts of characteristics would not be registrable as trademarks. Where I struggle is, from my mind, I can sort of see how you might be able to argue those same arguments under general distinctiveness grounds in any event. But we have this new rule, it's going to be used. We might have opponents that come up with novel ways of getting marks off the register because it's something to do with other characteristics that are necessary for technical results. And it's something to sort of keep in mind when you're at the registry or at the office trying to oppose marks or trying to get them registered. We'll have to see how that one plays out. The next change, thankfully, is a little bit more clear, and we actually sort of know what this one means. This is the change in light of the IP translator case. I'm sure you all know by now, the IP translator case was about the specification of goods and services. Before that case, the OHIM had the practice that if you used a class heading in your specification, it was held to cover all the goods and services within that class. However, the CJU in IP Translator said that's not correct. Specification should be given their sort of literal meaning. And so that has been brought into effect in the new trademark regulation and in the directive. The provision, as it states on the slide, simply you've got to identify your services and your goods with sufficient clarity and precision, similar wording to last time, to enable the extent of protection to be determined. So what does that actually mean? Well, what it means is you can still use class headings, but they will only be given their literal meaning. So if they're not clear and precise enough on their literal meaning, they're not going to be accepted, and they're not going to give any protection. I think what's important to bear in mind here is the regulation has actually brought in a sort of transitional provision, which sounds like it could be extremely useful for clients who have marks that were registered, so EU trademarks that were registered prior to the IP translator case. So if you are a proprietor of a trademark that was registered before the 22nd of June, sorry, filed before the 22nd of June 2012, and that specifies class headings within the specification, you're given a 6-month window in which you can amend your specification. And the way it works is you can do nothing. And in that case, your trademark will just cover the literal meaning of what is originally a class heading and is now just a literal meaning of goods and services. Or you have the option now to make a declaration that actually what you intended was to cover the full list of goods and services within that class heading. And having made that declaration, you can then specify exactly which goods and services it was intended that the specification would cover. So it gives you the opportunity as a trademark proprietor to, in effect, although probably fairly given the circumstances of the OHIM's practice at the time, but in effect to sort of broaden your trademark. But it is subject to two exceptions. It's not a sort of blanket expansion. There are two exceptions. If you do amend your specification, so if you get rid of the class heading and you specify the exact goods and services that you want, you cannot use that amended trademark to prevent third parties who commenced use prior to amendment, so who commenced their use before you change your specification. You can't use it to stop them doing what they're doing if what they're doing wouldn't have infringed on the literal meaning. So it's trying to balance the rights of a trademark owner who had a genuine intention for their trademarks to cover a broad specification of goods and services with the rights of third parties who have perhaps consulted the register and amended their actions accordingly in light of what the register said at that time. So that's the first exception. You can't use it to prevent use of a trademark. And in the same vein, you can't use it to invalidate or oppose a trademark which was filed before your amendment was changed, your sort of specification was amended. So that's the amendments about IP Translator. I now want to come on to look at the changes in the directive and the regulation to the acts which constitute trademark infringement. And I'm going to go through four of them. We've got one on this page and three on the next page. And this one relates to counterfeit goods in transit. In essence, the new directive and the new regulation enables trademark proprietors to prevent the entry of infringing goods and their placement in any, in effect, any form of customs situation. So goods in transit, shipment, warehouses, free zones, temporary storage, etc., etc. So what we've got really is a complete change in practice on that point. Originally, if you were a EU trademark proprietor and you wanted to enforce your EU trademark against counterfeit goods, you had to show one of three things. You had to show that they were either released for free circulation in the EU, you had to show that they were intended for the EU market, or that they were the subject of some sort of commercial act that was directed to EU customers. That's now gone. If you can show an act, a sort of a customs act, so putting it in transit, in shipment, in warehousing, as I said, the entry of the goods, you can rely on that act as an act of infringement. But, like the last example, it's not absolute. There are exceptions. And the exception here is that if the importer can show that the country of final destination, so the actual place where the goods are going to be sold, if they can show that in that country, the trademark proprietor would not be able to prevent their sale, so wouldn't succeed in an action in that country, then you can't succeed in the EU. And I think this is actually quite important and quite a big change, because in effect, what it's doing is it's making EU trademarks a valuable resource for companies that actually don't trade at all in the EU. You know, it may be of interest to sort of US companies or Chinese companies, but if they have counterfeit goods that come through Europe, an EU trademark might be a very valuable asset for them, even if in reality they don't actually use an EU trademark and perhaps it would be, you know, possible to be revoked at some stage. But it might be a sort of real sort of commercial benefit for them to register an EU trademark. The other infringing acts that have been introduced are on this slide. I'm going to take them in reverse order. Third one, using comparative advertising. That's simply a sort of clarification of the position as it currently is. Use in comparative advertising is an act of infringement unless you can bring yourself within the criteria of the comparative advertising directive. The second new act of infringement is use of the trading name or a company name. Not so controversial, but a sort of a clear act of infringement now, no argument on it. And the first one on the slide, what I've sort of dubbed preparatory acts, is a new act of infringement and really is a sort of change. What you can now use as an act of infringement is not only affixing the sign to goods, which was obviously already an act of infringement, but affixing signs to the packaging or labels or security features or authenticity features, so the sort of extra products that go with goods that enable them to get to the market. So affixing signs to those items, to those signs, to those security features, or taking a step back, and sort of the secondary infringement act, I suppose, is sort of offering, placing on the market or importing those security features, those labels, those authenticity features. So it's an extra step back. It enables you to attack infringement at an earlier level, where parties haven't yet perhaps got the goods ready for sale, but they started the process and they started making the packaging and the labels. So it enables you to get, as I said, a step further back in the chain and act earlier as a proprietor. So that's the acts of infringement. What about defences? Well, as I said earlier, one of the big changes is to the own name defence, only going to be available to personal defendants, so to individuals and not to corporate entities. But that's not the only change to defences. It's also been clarified that use to refer to the genuine goods of the trademark proprietor, so sort of referential use, as it's been called, is now permitted, and there's a sort of specific defence that deals with that. Now, I don't think any of us really doubted that that was the case. It's brought in this sort of specific defence within the regulation, within the directive, that makes that clear, so it puts that beyond doubt. The third defence that's on this slide, it is a change. And the defence is that a defendant in infringement proceedings is now going to be able, when the directive is implemented, but is now going to be able to put the claimant to proof of use. Ordinarily, the position was, as a defendant, if you were faced with being sued for infringement of a trademark, if you wanted to allege that the trademark hadn't been used for the last 5 years, you would make a counterclaim and seek that the trademark was cancelled on the basis of non-use. Now you don't have to take that proactive step of making a counterclaim. You can just raise the defence that the mark hasn't been used and push the burden onto the claimant to prove use without taking the sort of proactive step of applying for revocation. So it doesn't make too much of a difference substantively. You can still get to the same outcome, but it does make a difference procedurally in terms of how you get there. And possibly it saves you that sort of extra worry of issuing a counterclaim and then having the possible damages on the counterclaim not following the damages on the main claim. So you can come to the same position we had before, but you can do it without having to do that counterclaim. So those are defences. The last two slides on the substantive changes that I want to look at, I've titled intervening rights. What we're really looking at here is a situation where you have two parties, both with trademarks, one earlier, one later, or perhaps one is a sort of application at a later date. But how do you interact in those sort of situations? In the UK, we have this specific defence where if you're sued for infringement of a UK trademark, it is a defence simply to say, but we have a UK trademark registration. And that is an absolute defence to infringement of a UK trademark. But that defence doesn't exist in community trademark law, in EU trademark law. But what these new laws are doing, the new directive, the new regulation, are sort of coming part of the way there. It's not a pure defence in the sort of simplest of senses of, I don't infringe and that's it. But the new regulation, the new directive, is seeking to sort of deal with that situation where you've got conflicting trademark registrations. And it does that in two ways. It brings in two rules on this point. So the first rule, set out in the first bullet point on the slide, is that it's not possible to invalidate a trademark registration relying on your earlier trademark registration if you couldn't have prevented the registration of that later mark. So if you couldn't have successfully opposed it at the time at which it was applied for, you cannot later invalidate it. And so what that's driving at is there might be situations where right now you are in a position that you can invalidate someone's mark because, let's say, you have acquired a reputation, so you could rely on Section 5.3, or you've perhaps not acquired a reputation, but you've got enhanced distinctive character in your mark, and therefore that would lead more easily to a finding of likelihood of confusion under Section 5.2. Or perhaps your mark probably shouldn't have been let on the register, but it was, and now you feel confident in it because you've acquired distinctiveness, and so there's no way it would now be invalidated. That's today. But going back to when the later trademark was applied for, perhaps those criteria that you now can satisfy, you may not have been able to satisfy them back when the trademark was applied for. And if that is the case, you are now no longer permitted to invalidate those trademarks. So that's the first provision. The second provision deals more with preventing use of marks. So we're talking about infringement. And the second provision provides that, in effect, you have a defence if the proprietor of the earlier trademark who is trying to sue you cannot invalidate your trademark. So if they cannot invalidate it, then they cannot sue you for infringement of their own trademark. And the same sort of reasoning applies. So the reason perhaps that they could sue you now but couldn't invalidate your trademark is because at the time when you applied for it, they didn't have a reputation, they didn't have enhanced distinctive character, they didn't have acquired distinctiveness. Well, it could be a bit broader. It could be that at the time they'd sort of acquiesced to your trademark application. So if they cannot invalidate your later trademark, then they can't sue you and they can't prevent you from using it. But it works both ways. You also cannot sue them for infringement of your trademark because you're not going to be able to invalidate their earlier mark. So that the sort of the test works both ways. So that's intervening rights. And that was my last sort of detailed exposition of a substantive change. But there are other ones, and I've listed a few on the slide that's before you right now. Most of these are sort of relatively straightforward or relatively uncontroversial. And it's probably worth pointing out that the tweak that the CJE had to make to the wording of Article 85 or Article 91C regarding similar, dissimilar goods has now been properly clarified. It's clear that if you want to rely on Article 91C of the directive, you can do so if there are similar or dissimilar goods. So that's been clarified. And we now, in 2017, will have the opportunity to apply for an EU certification mark. So that's sort of a brand new system that's being introduced. So those are the substantive changes. I now want to have a run through some of the procedural changes, starting with the fee structure. As you know, the previous fee structure was a fixed fee for the three classes and then the additional fee for each class on top of that. We're now moving to a one class, one fee system. So it's slightly cheaper if you want to apply for one class. You've got 850 euros. error on my slides I've just seen. 850 euros, 900 for two classes, and then plus 150 for each additional class. So if you want to apply for a one-class trademark, wait till next Wednesday. If you want to apply for two, three, or four, get in there now, goes up in price. The effect of that, we don't know quite how, we don't know what the effect will be. The recitals to the regulation are hopeful that it will encourage sort of smaller businesses to apply for trademarks. Seems possibly slightly optimistic given the price difference is only 50 euros, but you never know. The other aim in changing the structure was to avoid these sort of overly broad trademark specifications. So it sort of avoids people applying for an EU trademark from simply putting in three classes because they can. You know, they've paid for it, they may as well use it. It's trying to avoid that and make people think a bit more clearly and a bit more sort of restrictively about actually what they want to protect and what they are willing to pay to protect. So that's the fees for applications. Fees for renewals, oppositions, cancellations, and appeals are also being reduced. Renewals quite significantly. Commissions estimated that the average saving on renewals is going to be around 37%. I don't know quite what that's based on. Presumably it's sort of based on the fact that most CCMs are in three classes. But so it's going to be quite a significant cost saving. So obviously very important sort of for filings and for renewals. That's quite interesting, so I'm going to move on. But thought it was probably worth highlighting for you all. And then the final thing I want to do for is run through some of the other administrative or procedural changes that are being brought in. and I'll run through them relatively speedily. So the top one, you can now only apply for an EU trademark at the EU IPO. The other avenues of sort of applying for them in the sort of local offices was rarely used, so I understand, and that's why that's just been got rid of to make it a little bit more streamlined, a bit more easy to understand. Renewals, importantly, you can now only request these prior to the date of expiry. You don't have that sort of leeway that we used to have. That's gone. Now it's going to be done prior to the date for expiry. IRs designating the EU. Same length of opposition period, still 3 months, but it now is going to start 1 month after it's been published rather than 6 months. Disclaimers are gone, well, not quite, almost gone as of next Wednesday. So if you want one, go now. But yeah, that's completely been removed. I suppose on the other side of the coin, in terms of making things a little more complicated again, you can actually now file written observations on absolute grounds on any trademark. You don't need permission, you can just put it in. I don't know how much it's going to be used, we'll have to wait and see. But it could be quite interesting. That's the written observations. And finally, searches. If you want a search report, you're going to have to ask for it. People that come up in search reports will still be notified, but you don't get your copy. You don't get a copy of that search report unless you specifically want one and request one and pay for one. So that's it. That's the whistle-stop tour. There are many more changes, but hopefully those are the main ones, and hopefully that was of use.